Budget shortfalls, tax policy, gaming, public pensions. Illinois lawmakers finished the first 2 weeks of their fall veto session with those issues left on the table. One issue no longer on the table, the smart grid bill. It flew through the General Assembly early in the veto session. Also approved, pay for regional school superintendents and a plan to aid the state's unemployment insurance program. This morning, we'll take a look at what happened and what didn't, and what might happen when the legislature returns to the State House 1 week from today. Two observers of the State House are with us this morning. They are University of Illinois political scientists Chris Mooney and Brian Gaines. Brian Gaines is on the faculty at Urbana. Chris Mooney is on the faculty at Springfield. Both are members of the Institute of Government and Public Affairs. Listeners, join the discussion with a phone call or by email. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Toll free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. And the email address is will-talk@illinois.edu. Chris Mooney and Brian Gaines, good morning. How are the two of you?
Very good, Celeste.
Fine, thank you.
Okay. Well, I suppose one of the things that we're watching carefully is the proposal for the expansion of gaming. Will it go anywhere next week?
Well, I think this is Chris, and I think this is a dead duck. It's been a dead duck ever since the governor said that he wanted to monkey with the thing. I mean, expansion of gaming, they've been trying to do this for over 15 years, and every year it comes up, gets more or less along through the process. And the problem is that, in general, lawmakers, don't want to vote for this thing because there are certain negatives, and Quinn brought up many of them. He doesn't want to expand gambling. He doesn't want to turn us into the Nevada of the Midwest and so forth. But on the other hand, you can incentivize lawmakers to get on board by, throwing a casino in their direction or helping out a racetrack, putting good slots if they're, if that's in their area and so forth. So you it's pretty much log rolling politics at its purest. The problem is that you can't put enough on the plate, on the gambling plate, before the thing gets too top heavy and falls over. It always reminds me of when I was a kid, I was a busboy at a restaurant for a while, and you'd get a big tray and you'd have it on, you'd put one thing and then another thing and then another thing. Before you know it, it was just too darn big to carry. And that's what's gone on with this. And this year, and this bill that's gone through, has gone farther than any bill has gone since the original gambling bill in the 90s, and or the casino bill in the 90s. And it's really a testament to the doggedness of Representative Lou Lang from Skokie, who's been working on this forever. So he has this thing precariously balanced, this tray of dishes, and here comes Pat Quinn. He works it through the Senate and the House, and everything is just balanced just so. And here comes Pat Quinn, and he doesn't want to just take off a spoon or a fork. He wants to take off half of the plates, and this is immediately throws everything into a tizzy. So, as soon as he says he doesn't want slots at the state fairgrounds, for example, right away Raymond Poe and Larry Bomke, who are the Springfield, two of the Springfield lawmakers, they said, well, forget it then. Why should we vote for this? And they're off. There's somebody up in Rockford. If they talk about taking that casino off, well, why is this guy going to? So as much as they're talking about it, it's completely dead.
Yeah. Brian Gaines, here's a question for you. Is this good public policy?
I guess the question is it good public policy if it doesn't go through, or is it a good idea?
Yeah.
I think it's a little Groundhog Day-ish that, as Chris says, we just keep hearing about it year after year. It never goes anywhere. It's if you want a good argument against it, maybe the one is that Nevada is, we just heard about the new unemployment statistics. Nevada's got the worst unemployment in the nation. It's been that way for almost 2 years. And it smacks of desperation. The government desperately needs revenue. Expanding gambling is not very different from a kind of tax, except it turns out to be a quite regressive tax because the revenue doesn't come from the most wealthy. And lots of studies will show that most of the people doing most of the gambling probably not shouldn't be doing it. So it does produce government revenue, produces a lot of social costs. The reason both sides can produce studies that say it's good or it's bad for the state is because the social costs are so hard to measure. But it's really no panacea. It's not the way out of the huge fiscal hole we're in, and it's kind of a shame that we just keep hearing this record played over and over again and not moving on to some other issues. And I agree with Chris that we'll have it again next year because it's not going to come out of this session.
No, but I'm sorry. Go ahead, Chris.
I was going to say it looks it's like magic beans, right? I mean, it's free money. It's a tax on stupidity, or it's not a tax. It's a voluntary fee for the service of entertainment or whatever. But the problem is not only it is it's a regressive tax, a regressive source of income, as Brian suggests, but as more and more states have gotten more and more into this gambling world over the course of the last sort of generation, the pot of money available to suck out of people who want to participate in this activity gets smaller and smaller, and that's one of the problems that we're seeing in the politics of the thing right now. The current casinos and the lobbyists for the casinos that exist now are adamantly against this because they know this will cannibalize some of their economy or some of the money that's going into them. And what this demonstrates, and we've seen study after study in recent years, is showing that revenue is dwindling on gambling. In any way, government revenue is dwindling on it. So there's a finite level that you can get out of these people.
Yeah, proponents have said this thing would bring Illinois $1 billion in new revenue. And the governor's office says, yeah, hardly. And the administration released a report this week saying the revenue would amount to $160 million.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the estimates are all over the map, and it's partly because you're making guesses about future behavior, and you have to factor in the other forms of gambling that are available. One of the things that has made land-based casinos harder is that there's more online gambling these days, even if it's not strictly legal. So I'm not surprised to see huge discrepancies in the estimates. I think you should take $1 billion with a big grain of salt, big chunk of salt. Even if it's $160 million, the proponents say, look, that's $160 million we wouldn't have otherwise. But then you get into the second cost debate about, well, what are the costs associated with it? What kind of social costs do you get? If you're going to collect that revenue and simultaneously see people who are towards the poverty line slipping below, and then they're going to need government assistance of some kind or unemployment assistance, then maybe it's all illusory.
Yeah. There was a story in the paper this weekend on Sunday that I found very interesting, and it's maybe a bit of a sidebar here, but it says that essentially more than 2 years after Governor Quinn signed the law for the video gambling thing, that Illinois still doesn't have all the regulations or a centralized computer system in place to launch this network of betting terminals at bars and restaurants and so on. And this involves the Illinois Gaming Board. And I guess my question is here, what do we know about the public? That is, somebody like me, what do we know about the Illinois Gaming Board and what kind of teeth do they have? What kind of oversight do they have?
Well, this is something that the governor is actually quite concerned about, and that's one of the things that he is concerned with this particular gambling bill we just got done talking about, because the gambling bill circumvents the gaming board in a number of ways, especially in locating the casinos. They basically locate them by legislative fiat instead of going through the gaming board, which is the way that has been done in the past. And the gaming board has a fair amount of teeth. Gambling has to be regulated very strictly because there is so much money involved. It's cash money oftentimes, or it can be. There's a reason why organized crime has often dwelled in the world of gambling, number one, because it's often been illegal, and so there's demand for it, but also because, there's money. And Vegas in that world, in the sort of pre-1970 world, when it was heavily dominated by organized crime, you just had all this cash flowing in, and that's when that's the sort of world that you know, crooks want to get involved in. So you have to have a gaming board that's tight. And we do, by and large, have pretty good restrictions and regulations on our gaming, casino gaming in the state. Now, when you start moving away from the, you know, half dozen or whatever it is casinos that we have, land-based casinos, and you move into video gambling, you know, in bars and restaurants all over the state, suddenly things are a lot more difficult to regulate. And that's one of the main reasons that the Gaming Board has not got this thing figured out quite yet. Another big reason is that the Quinn administration, you know, their strong suit is not in administration, okay? Or let's say the governor's strong suit is not in management, and this would require strong management on his part, and not just, you know, the Game Board is independent, but the governor has a lot of opportunity to get this thing moving, and it's seems like that's not happening.
Hmm. This is Focus. We're talking this morning about the Illinois General Assembly and the veto session that is about to wrap up. Two observers of the State House are with us. They are University of Illinois political scientists Chris Mooney and Brian Gaines. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with a phone call or by email, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, toll-free 800-222-9455. The email address, will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, let's go to the phones and take some calls. First, we go to Champaign County, line one. Good morning.
Hi. I'm trying to think of the right metaphor. It's like rearranging the baccarat tables on the Titanic or something to talk about this much. What I wanted to ask about, there was a whole long series in the local paper, so I guess there's no attention to the scandal of the delayed bill payments, but I don't remember if they actually emphasized the fact that there was some effort, and even the Chamber of Commerce backed the debt consolidation concept. We owe this money already. We're constitutionally obliged to pay 12% interest on it. It just doesn't make any sense, and maybe they actually did resolve that, but I don't think so. But it's not covered as much as it ought to be. Have they resolved this in any way?
Not at all. I mean, it's totally out there right now. And the main reason that, I mean, Quinn wants to borrow money, and he can get, you know, the state is good for the money, more or less, on the bond market and get a lot better rate than 12%. And so, you know, his plan is to borrow or bond this debt, pay off the vendors, and then end up paying sort of 6-5% or whatever they'd have to pay, and save millions and millions of dollars. The problem is that, by and large, as far as I can tell, it's the Republicans, especially in the House, that just aren't going to have it. They don't want to. You know, it's basically, I think, for political reasons. Because, as you mentioned, it doesn't make any sense financially.
It's a lose-lose situation in a way, because even with a 12% a rather high penalty rate, but even with that rate, a lot of the vendors say they're still losing money. They're getting the payments so late. But the suspicion is that any plan which solves the or even addresses the late payments by borrowing more is just going to increase the total indebtedness. And I think
no, it doesn't. Doesn't increase the total indebtedness. It's a debt consolidation loan.
But it's a debt consolidation loan.
They can do it that way.
They can do it that way. The question is, will they do it that way?
I think the interest rate is low, but obviously that's not.
It sounds like, yeah.
The arithmetic of the interest rates is straightforward. I think the suspicion is once the politicians in Springfield get a chance to get any more money by any means, they're going to find out they're going to spend it many more times than once.
Hmm. Yes, and that's happened before. I mean, they did a thing early in the Blagojevich administration where they bonded out some they did basically an arbitrage scheme, which is what this would be, on having to do with a pension, and all it did was make matters worse and gave Rob Blagojevich, you know, a couple $1 billion just to do, you know, things with it. Didn't seem to do much.
Yeah. I'm gonna thank the listener for his call. Let's take another call. This is a listener in Urbana. Line two, hi.
Good morning. For both of your guests, was there any reaction from your sources in Springfield to the recent conviction of William Cellini?
Well, yeah, I live in Springfield, as was mentioned, and you know, Cellini is a quiet person. He's not one of these out there all the time in public making a lot of speeches. In fact, very few people I know have even heard him give a public speech or hardly any commentary in public. For some people, he's sort of well liked in the sense that he donates a lot of money. His wife is very involved in historical preservation, and he's known as a good employer, and we hear a lot of good testimony, even by the prosecution witnesses in his trial. They were saying, "Wow, everybody loves him. He took this one secretary, kept her on the payroll when she was hurt, and all these nice things." So there is an element. It's not even necessarily a nefarious element or whatever in Springfield that finds him to be a relatively sympathetic character, and that he just got caught up in this sort of Keystone Cops shakedown process. Among the political people, I think what this demonstrates is that even somebody as savvy as Bill Cellini, somebody who knows where the line is and has danced up to it and back many times over the years and become a rich man because of it, because of his skill in doing so, even he can get caught up these sort of legal problems when you have, number one, a lot of temptation, a lot of pressure from very unethical governor and an aggressive federal prosecutor. So my hope is, as with all these scandals that we've been just one after another having to deal with in this last decade, that they're going to learn a little lesson and be a little more careful.
Thank you.
Brian Gaines, do you think that's likely?
Well, I wouldn't want to bet a lot on it. We've got a pretty long history of rule bending, rule breaking in the state, and it'd be nice to think that the Resco sentencing will be the end of the line of it's the last of the figures connected to Blagojevich. There's no more pending trial, but I don't see anything that looks sort of like Louisiana is one of the other states that people have pointed to in the past having a culture of corruption, and there it's early to conclude anything, but it looks like Bobby Jindal has made really serious ethics reform a priority in a way that I just don't think we've seen in Springfield yet. So I'd love to think that we won't have further high-level scandals either in the governor's office, the legislature, wherever. But I don't really see a good reason to think that it's behind us.
And this has just come down from the Associated Press. A federal judge has sentenced a former top fundraiser for Illinois' ousted Governor Rod Blagojevich to 10.5 years in prison, I think. The AP didn't come through for us there in terms of a good broadcast style, in prison for corruption. He will get credit for time he has served. Attorneys for Antoine Tony Resco had hoped U.S. District Judge Amy St. Eve would sentence him to 33.5 years that he's already served. The 56-year-old former real estate developer was convicted in 2008 of fraud, money laundering, and plotting to squeeze $7 million in kickbacks from firms wanting to do business with the state during Blagojevich's tenure. So 10.5 years in prison. Any comments there?
Well, that's a lot of time, and that's a significant amount. Here's a guy, and here's a guy who was willing, but not very willing, to testify against Rob Blagojevich and some of the people up the line from him. They got him early. He did not immediately turn on his superiors, as did the drug-addled sex maniac Levine, who testified again and again at trial. Most recently with Cellini trial, Resco never testified at trial. I think we were led to believe that he would have, but the prosecutors did not bring him in, and one suspects that maybe that's because they thought that he wasn't a good witness, or that he, you know, that he was to come, came too late to the party. You know, and these prosecutors, what they have leverage on the underlings, and whether they're looking at a drug supply chain or a chain of political corruption. They get the guy at the bottom, they squeeze him to get the next guy up, and so forth up the chain until they get the big fish at the top. And if you are at the bottom and you're willing to roll quickly, eagerly, and effectively as a witness, you can get your sentence significantly reduced, and that's the leverage that they have. We haven't seen what's going to happen with Levine yet, but he'll probably get a lot less than that because he was very useful to the prosecution. Rezko was not useful, apparently, and gets slammed. I don't think that bodes well for what we're going to hear for Rob Blagojevich in the next couple weeks.
And if the Cellini verdict holds, do you think that there would be some incentive for Cellini to come forth with information that he has about others?
Well, it seems like they say he's not the end of the line, but I mean, where else are you going to go? They already have the governor, right? And usually what they want to do is they move up the line to get the big head on the wall, and then they move on to the next major scandal. And they've got the big head on the wall, right? The big head with the big hair. So what's next? I don't know.
Brian, any comment?
Yeah, no, I think this is the. I really haven't heard any scuttlebutt about where else they could look. That the dream for many Republicans was somehow to get Barack Obama tied into the whole Rezko Blagojevich mess. But I don't think there's anything more brewing.
Yeah. Let's take another call. This is a listener in Urbana, line one. Hi.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. There's lots of talk about the budget and restrictions, and they talk about things that cost millions and ten millions of dollars. Yet there's been very, very little talk about the $8 billion—that's billion-dollar capitation program in the state budget that was approved this year. And it just seems that although many jobs are dependent upon those state expenditures, that perhaps they could be tempered in some way so that the state of Illinois could dig itself out of the hole that it's in, rather than continue to dig itself deeper into the hole by really very, very expensive, that's $8 billion in capitation annually. I'd like you to comment on that.
Can you elaborate on that? I'm not sure what you're talking about, to be honest with you.
The state legislature approved spending $8 billion in capitation, roads, buildings.
Ah.
Capitalization.
Yes, got it.
Capital programs.
And that's $18 billion. And there hasn't been, well, there's been very, very little discussion of that. And it seems that if that expenditure was tempered a bit, the state could be digging itself out of its current financial hole rather than digging itself deeper into it. Why isn't anybody talking about that?
You want to say something about that, Brian?
I guess we have colleagues at the Institute of Government and Public Affairs and the public finance side who've have done some talking about the fact that we look at the state's finances. The tax rate raise alone was never going to solve the problem. So, I think on the whole, most of them said we did need to increase the income taxes. They approved that and said at the same time spending has to be controlled. And so I would agree with you that we're in such a big hole we can't get out of it without controlling spending in a serious way, and that doesn't mean kind of random interventions like the regional superintendent denying funding to regional school superintendents. It means serious cross-the-board sorts of cuts. But politicians are not good at cutting spending anywhere. I think we're watching that in D.C. right now. The super committee, which was supposed to be a way to get around the usual incentives for piling spending on that come with from log rolling and you scratch my back and I scratch yours and so on, still couldn't come up with anything that was palatable to both parties. So it Does the state of Illinois spend too much? Absolutely. Part of it now, of course, part of the problem is spending a lot in interest and spending money on late payment penalties. But beyond that, the state finances are dire enough that we simply can't afford to spend as much as we are. But there's not a good constituency for that. And we've just seen a lack of leadership from any politician sort of willing to be governor or legislator, no, who says, no, we can't do that. No.
Well, this is an $18 billion item in the state budget. And for nobody to be talking about it, there must be some pretty serious reasons or pressure not to discuss this in public. When I contacted my legislators, one did respond and pointed out that pays for 25,000 jobs within the state of Illinois. Yet on the other side of the discussion is that millions of people are being affected by the shortcomings in the state's current finances, which could be very, very seriously dealt with in a constructive way if the amount spent on capital programs was reduced.
Yeah, you know, I guess.
So why isn't anybody talking about this?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's hard to. I mean, why isn't anybody talking about it? It's hard to speculate on that. But one thing about capital you have to think about is that there's a pretty strong consensus in this country among range of the whole spectrum of political thought in the general public, that one of the what is government supposed to do? Well, one of the things that the government is supposed to do is to develop infrastructure by which commerce and society can through which society and commerce can function, sort of water systems and highways and schools and prisons and these sort of long-term expenditures. And they can't, the private market can't deal with these sorts of things. That's why governments have, spontaneously developed over the course of human history over the last 5,000 years or whatever that we've been dealing with major government, activity, that's a role for government that most people agree is something that should be doing. If the government stops spending, if states stop spending on capital projects, things would fall apart fast. And in fact, there's a lot of people. There's a strong argument that's made these days that the government is not spending enough on capital projects. There are bridges and roads are falling down around the country. One in Minneapolis that fell down was a dramatic example. But, I've seen reports about, I was just doing some work in Pennsylvania recently, and there was a report, and that's a state with lots of bridges. There was a report that said, I think it was in Pittsburgh, which is a city of bridges, something like 60% of the bridges were deficient in some way or more than, it was a lot, and that's because we're not spending enough. So that's just an argument that one might make to say, well, maybe we're not spending enough on these sorts of things.
I'll just make two more brief comments. Illinois Jobs Now is the catchy label for the capital plan. So I think whether it's good or bad economics, the justification for the spending has been that this kind of spending will actually help with the serious unemployment problem. And you could easily argue that we've seen from the federal stimulus plan that's wrong, that Keynesian economics was just doesn't have the incentives right. But certainly that from the political side, the justification for spending so much has been that. And the other has another just wrinkle to this is there have been matching federal funds. So states have been able to say we have to spend money on things the federal government's going to give us basically free money for. It's not free if you're a taxpayer because you're paying for it one way or another. But if you're a state budget maker, then as long as there's federal money to match, it gives you a very obvious incentive to take it, and that means to spend more. But is anyone talking about this? I think the sort of arguments that you're making are probably being made by people on the Tea Party side. if there are legislators making it, I think for the moment they're still in the minority. But I would come back to the point that in the end, it does seem that the state is just spending too much money.
Right, and people are definitely talking about that. I mean, especially not you know, it's not just a partisan issue. It is largely it's a debate along party lines, as one might expect. But you know, the Speaker of the House, Mike Madigan, is a fiscally conservative guy, and he's very concerned. You know, in his own quiet, close to the vest way, he's very concerned with the overspending of the state, and so I think there, you know, it's not that it's not being discussed in the general issue of overspending.
This is Focus. We're talking this morning about state politics and the legislative veto session. Our guests, Illinois political scientists Chris Mooney and Brian Gaines. More after a short break.
On the next Fresh Air, we hear Francis Ford Coppola on stage at the Toronto Film Festival telling stories behind his films, like when actors from The Godfather first met at an Italian dinner party he threw. Marlon Brando was at the table's head.
To his right was Pacino, you know, who was trying to impress Brando with how silent and intense he could be. And
join us.
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
Support comes from World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods at the intersection of 6th and University in Champaign, featuring foods from around the world, including imported chocolates, cookies, cheeses, and gift baskets for the holidays. Also, World Harvest carries fine specialty ingredients like saffron, smoked paprika, truffle salt, grain of paradise, and more.
This is Focus. My name is Celeste Quinn, and with us this morning, two observers of the State House. They are University of Illinois political scientists Chris Mooney and Brian Gaines. Listeners, you can join us this morning with a question, a comment. Join us with a phone call or by email. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, and the email address is will-talk@illinois.edu. Chris, I'm thinking back to your story about that big tray you carried as a busboy a long time ago. And I'm thinking of this bill that is now before the legislature. It's a package-changing tax policy. And its aim was to keep commodity exchanges and Sears from moving out of the state. But there's a lot more in there now. What are the prospects for the bill?
Well, I mean, you're exactly right that this is one of those sort of Christmas tree bills, is one expression, where people just add one thing onto another until it, and you know, the I don't know, the analogy is you put one too many ornaments on, the thing falls over, or you could call it a Jenga tower is another one. But there was a very, you know, there's a very serious problem with Chicago Mercantile Exchange tax rate. The way the tax system is set up, you've got and the corporate tax system is what gets taxed and when. The CME ends up paying like a pretty large percent of the overall corporate tax revenue in the state, way beyond what you would think would be most people look at it and think this is unreasonable. Some corporations will even pay zero, and they're paying a certain percentage. It's not like 50% or anything, but it's for one corporation, it's pretty high. And the reasonable people looked at that and they said, wow, that's not good. And given the fact that they're the kind of organization that can up and leave if they want to, because they don't have, you know, there's no reason they need to be in Chicago other than the fact that they've been there for 150 some years. You've got a lot of aggressive, largely Republican governors, and many of them sort of newly elected in 2010, who see this as, wouldn't this be wonderful and a great way to stick it to the state of the president, for one thing, by moving the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, somewhere else, move it to Gary or move it to Columbus, Ohio, or wherever. So anyway, that's where it starts. And also Sears in a similar way, similar situation, not quite as severe as CME. But so you start that off and then, say, well, let's give a corporation, let's give this, profitable corporation tax break. Some people say that doesn't look right. You know, the governor, for example, hey, why, we can't do that. We need to add a tax break for the average hardworking Illinoisan, right? So let's, or at least the low-income Illinoisan. So let's include some more the earned income credit. Let's crank that up a little bit. And then what about small business? They're out here, you know, the engine of the economy. What about this? What about that? Before you know it, it went from the CME program was originally, I think, like $40 million that was needed. Now it's up to, you know, $850 million mm-hmm. by adding on all these different things. And is it going to get through? That I think it's up in the air. I don't know what's going to happen. I think this it's vitally important politically, and I think probably for the state it's pretty important that CME and Sears not up and leave. If that happened, the governor and the Democratic Party, who are controlling politics in the state, would just take a huge hit in the face. So I think that they will work something out to keep the CME from leaving, and probably Sears too. The other stuff, you know, who knows? And I don't know how they're going to, you know, how they're going to square that circle, but they have incentive to do so.
Yeah. Let me make a quick public opinion point that public opinion on taxes are notoriously hard to measure because so it's always true in surveys that you can move results around by changing your wording. But in taxes in particular, a lot of the most popular items are exceptionally vague. So if you find out that people want the rich to pay more in taxes, you don't really know what it means unless you know what the rich are. But it's almost always true in surveys that people will tell you they want corporations to pay higher taxes. Economists will tell you that's a bad idea, that it's rooted in a misunderstanding of what a corporation is. Almost all economists would say what you want is a highly transparent but low corporate tax. But one reason this is very thin ice for politicians to be walking on is no matter what they can say about the importance for jobs of keeping companies in Illinois, there's a very strong resistance to increasing income taxes for individuals, ordinary people, and simultaneously giving breaks and incentives to companies. And I think we see the Occupy, fill in the name of the city or street, movement is one manifestation of unhappiness with the notion that somehow tax policy always helps the most wealthy and that doesn't help others. So it's not, even if there's a very sound economic argument for the importance of CME or Sears, I think there's a reason for politicians to be wary. And somewhat coincidentally, but maybe not, as the smart grid, just after the smart grid bill override, there was a story which maybe didn't get a huge amount of attention about a loophole in campaign finance law, which meant that ComEd had actually been able to essentially give out a lot more money than they had been meant to under the last campaign finance bill. Now, that doesn't surprise anyone who studies campaign finance. There are always loopholes. They're always found. But it does increase the sense that for people who are cynical that companies have ways to buy the votes they need in Springfield and ordinary voters don't. So if I were a legislator, I'd be very nervous about the argument that by any means necessary, we have to keep companies here.
A report I read put the amount of money spent on lobbying for the smart grid bill, all the parties together, somewhere between $900,000 and $1 million.
Well, depending on how you count that, I mm-hmm. mean, you're talking about campaign contributions?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Could be.
So, in terms of Illinois tax policy, what does it look like when compared with other states?
Well, we had been a relatively low income tax state. The income tax increase pushes us up. There are still, I've forgotten the exact number, but maybe 14 or 15 states that don't have an income tax. So we're in the middle of the pack. We're not, we've moved from being low in the low middle to the high middle, but we're not the highest state. We're not the lowest. In some other taxes, we're unusually high. Gasoline tax, which is basically invisible to the consumer. They just know what they're paying. They don't know how much of it is taxes. Illinois is amongst the highest. Corporate taxes were, and also following the last increase, were unusually high. But it's actually quite a difficult thing to say. Adding all the taxes together, how do you rank the states? Because there are so many different taxes, and they get hard to compare once you bring in the complexity of the 50 different tax codes.
What stands in the way of a better tax policy for Illinois?
Or for the United States?
Yeah.
It's something that if there were a dictator for a day, you picked a Nobel-winning economist and said, "Your dictator today, draw a better tax code," he or she could do it. But the politics are extremely difficult. And I guess I'll pick one example, the federal mortgage interest deduction. That's another thing in surveys people say they like. They want a simplified tax code. Everybody wants a simplified tax code. If you ask whether or not they should be able to deduct mortgage interest, people say yes. Well, that's a way to benefit some taxpayers at the expense of others. It complicates the code. It makes collection harder. But it's popular because it's something a lot of people get. The provisions in the tax code aren't accidental. They're there because they serve somebody's interests. And simplifying it requires a huge effort and basically bipartisan deals.
Not to mention taxes, especially these days, are a particular hot button issue, especially the Tea Party sort of feeling is really centered around government spending and taxes. There's this guy out in Washington who's been out there working in sort of think tank / interest group since the Reagan administration, named Grover Norquist, who has, and some of you may have seen him on the, I think it was on 60 Minutes on Sunday night, they did an interview with him. And the guy has been a bulldog in working, especially with Republicans, almost exclusively with Republican candidates for Congress, but it's also bled over into state offices under no circumstances, swearing under no circumstances to raise people's taxes. And on the one hand, you may think, well, that's great. We don't want to have any more government spending. Government spends too much right now. It's bloated at all levels, and that's an open question. I think people can have, you know, definitely reasonable people have reasonable disagreements on that. But it's also the case that that we've got so many different kinds of taxes, and they're there, as Brian says, for different reasons. And just to say we're never going to raise one at any time under any conditions, that makes it difficult to change the tax code, because if you can't raise the one, maybe it's smart, maybe it makes good sense to raise one and decrease another. Maybe we should have more income tax and less property tax, or we should have a larger and more equally dispersed sales tax, for example. Well, that's raising a tax, even if you would go ahead and decrease another tax to compensate for it. So that makes it tough, too.
Yeah. This is Focus. We're talking this morning about the Illinois legislative veto session and state politics. My name is Celeste Quinn. Our guests, listeners, are University of Illinois political scientists Chris Mooney and Brian Gaines. And we have about 8 minutes left in this portion of the program. If you'd like to join us with a question, a comment, give us a call or drop us an email. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, toll-free 800-222-9455. The email address is will-talk@illinois.edu. Let's get back to the smart grid bill for a moment. The legislation allows ComEd and Ameren to raise rates for an upgrade of infrastructure, and the utilities will be able to raise rates on consumers to improve the infrastructure, the grid. I'm wondering, with the passage of this bill, do ComEd and Ameren, are they out from under the scrutiny of the Illinois Commerce Commission now, or what?
Chris could maybe correct me on this. I don't think it's a carte blanche. They get they're being allowed to raise rates to make improvements, and it's something any business would like to get the money first and improve second. But it doesn't. It's not unfettered in increases, and I guess I don't know what provisions are in place if the grid improvements never materialize. But I don't think that's the suspicion. I think the suspicion is the rates maybe will go up too fast, too high. Mm-hmm. If you're a consumer advocate, what you'd like to see is more improvements first.
Why did this legislation move so quickly?
Well, really, yes, there was a lot of lobbying. Yes, there are arguments on the side of letting them do this. I mean, you might say, well, the capital investment is so intense, that they wouldn't do these good things. Like I was talking about before with government capital expenditures. I mean, there comes a time when certain projects are just so darn big and so expensive that a corporation is not going to make those investments unless they've got some kind of incentive. So I'm not saying it was necessarily the right thing or the wrong thing, because I don't know the details enough, and that's where the devil is, of course, and any kind of utility regulation legislation. But the thing that really pushed this over, I think, was an animus and frustration with the governor among the legislators. I mean, the governor came out and he did his best imitation of Rod Blagojevich, saying how the legislators were being bought off, and it really reminded me of this sort of drunken sailor's tirade that the governor Blagojevich went on is sort of after his first legislative session. And Quinn was frustrated with the legislature because the legislature is not doing what he wants. He's not really, working very well with the legislature. So the only thing he can do, and the only way he can make, as people keep saying, the only way he can make himself relevant in the legislative process is to come out with a veto and say, look, I'm the governor, by God, and this I don't want. I'm going to veto this thing. And then he, made these comments, not very pleasant comments about the legislature. And the legislators appeared to be just mad. They took offense at his approach. And you saw the process in the legislative process of the override of the veto. You saw the legislature sticking it to the governor in a very explicit way. I mean, that for one thing, it overrode the governor's veto with more votes than were needed to override this thing, and that's almost unheard of. I mean, whenever there's going to be an override on a controversial bill, people don't want to vote on it if they don't have to, and so the leadership will kind of work it out and figure out who's least vulnerable, and then those are the people that vote on it, and then everybody else gets to vote against it, so they can say, look, I tried to keep this, the utilities at bay, but no. But that wasn't the case. There was more on there that they enthusiastically voted against him. Nobody stood up on the floor of the legislature, and especially in the House, or actually I don't think in the Senate either, and stood up for the governor. And has been pointed out, even Rod Blagojevich had, one or two people that would stand up and defend him, even as he moved it toward the end. And nobody would do that for Pat Quinn on this bill. And it was really kind of astonishing.
Let's take a call. This is a listener in Urbana, line one. Hi.
Hi. Hi. I was wanting to talk about the pension issue, but what you just said is further evidence that we need a clean sweep. Every single one of them needs to be swept out of office and a fresh start. It's appalling to me that their animus towards the governor would lead them to stick it to the taxpayers of the state simply because they don't like the way in which the governor addressed them. That is
good point.
Appalling.
Well,
the thing I really wanted to talk about, though, is the pension issue, because no matter how often we say it, the storyline in the media is that the state employees and the people who are in the state pension systems, the variety of systems, are somehow getting a free ride. The thing that most taxpayers don't know is, and the News Gazette and other newspapers won't tell them, is that we do not get Social Security. Every month there's a deduction from my paycheck that goes to the sewer system. I pay my share. The state does not pay theirs. And so if the state defaults on us, screws us, we don't have Social Security to fall back on. And what's even worse is, because from the federal government's perspective, I'm in a defined benefit plan, I don't qualify for many of the 401k plans and so on that people in the private sector can use to shelter savings for retirement. And I think it's just despicable. I've talked to my own legislator here in Urbana every year come budget time in the last 6 years, and it was always, don't worry, The Constitution protects you. We're not going to make a payment this year, but we're going to double up out years 3, 4, and 5 and get caught up.
I'm going to jump in here because we're running down on time, and I want our guests to comment, and all three of us are in the pension program as well. So
let me make an extremely brief comment on the first part about throwing everybody out of office. That I think the redistricting process has just played out, and it's not going to happen because the map was basically a behind closed doors gerrymander. Again, it was extremely disappointing, but unfortunately, the map has been drawn in a way to protect the current majority party. Now, the pension we could easily spend 50 minutes on. I'm located in California for the year, so I'm watching the eerie parallels between the two states, which both have a huge public pension problem. I'd agree with the caller in a couple of respects that the coverage has been poor in perhaps most of all in the fact that last spring we saw a lot of stories about how out of the blue, the legislature had produced a solution. There was cheering about the pension reform, and a few naysayers said this is just not enough. And essentially what they did is change provisions for new employees. But that we're in such a big hole in pensions that changing the rules for new employees down the line, even though that will have its own cost, doesn't get us out of the hole. So pension problems not solved. As Chris mentioned, the governor has come out of the fall session looking weaker and probably not in a good position to lead on it. And I don't really see anybody who's yet got a plan that's, never mind a painless plan that would address the problem, but a painful plan that would seriously address the extent of the problem. My last point on this is that part of the reason we're in a big, the pensions system stands out as a problem is just because it hasn't been funded. It's as though someone who doesn't have enough money to pay rent and car payments decides to stop paying car payments and then later says, well, clearly the problem is the car. It isn't if the problem was that you simply didn't make car payments and ended up with a much bigger debt. So the pension system needs some reform, but it's partly just because of choices made in the past to ignore it and sweep the problem down the road.
Chris, very quickly, after the election, do you think that there will be action taken on this issue?
After what election? Next year?
Yeah.
It's one of the hardest problems they've got because they've been putting it off for so long. I don't know what's going to happen. I have to punt on that one. It's a really terrible problem.
Okay. Well, maybe what we should do is take up that issue on another day and talk about public pensions in the state of Illinois. Chris Mooney,
Let's
Brian.
Do that on a rainy day.
Okay.
It Brian, is a rainy day. What are you talking about?
Oh, I'm in California. It's sunny here.
Chris Mooney and Brian Gaines, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Glad to do it.
Yeah, my pleasure, Celeste. Bye-bye.
Bye.